This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, people change their names for a variety of reasons, and those reasons have shifted a lot over the last century. We'll talk to a historian of ethnic identity about what our names mean to us and why we change them. Now, the Republican-controlled House last week passed a nearly $900 billion defense budget bill. It included some amendments that face big hurdles in the Senate and White House. Under the budget plan, the Defense Department would be barred from reimbursing soldiers' travel expenses related to abortion services. It would also cut health coverage for transgender hormone treatments or gender confirmation surgeries for service members. The National Defense Bill now heads to the Democratic-controlled Senate. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions? What would you like to know about the nation's defense budget and what's going on in Congress right now? What do you think about some of these hot-button issues, including some of the so-called culture war-related issues or funding for Ukraine that were hang-ups in the bill? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Caroline Coudrier covers defense and national security for CQ Roll Call. Caroline, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
This bill passed with a pretty tight margin, almost all Republicans voting for, almost all Democrats in the House voting against. What is normal? What usually comes out of these defense appropriation bills?
Yes, absolutely. The National Defense Authorization is one of the few bills that Congress does that actually is pretty much bipartisan almost every year. This year, the bill passed out of committee 58-1. With only one Democrat voting against it. So that just goes to show the typical bipartisan nature of the bill. But like you said, Republicans attached a series of quote-unquote culture war provisions during the floor debate on abortion, transgender health care, and diversity, equity, and inclusion programs at the Pentagon that caused all but four Democrats to ultimately vote against the bill. So it'll be interesting to see as the Senate considers its version and as representatives from both chambers go to conference later in the year to sort out what the White House finds acceptable, how many of these Republican provisions actually make it into the final bill, which has passed for the past 62 years. It's almost always bipartisan. And so this year, the Republican actions in the House are threatening that a little bit.
Can you talk about the dynamics within the Republican caucus in the House that that led to these items going into this bill?
Yes. So House Speaker Kevin McCarthy is working with a very, very narrow majority, and there are several ultra-conservative Freedom Caucus members who are really insistent on including their priorities in the legislation. And in order for Speaker McCarthy, who, as we remember back to January, was only elected Speaker after several rounds of voting, he has to sort of appease these far-right members who want to see their priorities included. So that's why the decision was made among leadership to allow votes on some of these amendments. And it's important to note that even though the bill does include some provisions on abortion, DEI, and transgender healthcare, there were also several provisions offered by some of these far-right members. Marjorie Taylor Greene from Georgia, as an example, offered several amendments to cut funding for Ukraine. Those were rejected. So not all of the priorities of these ultra-conservative members were included, but a lot of them were.
Now, this goes to the Senate. Democrats control the Senate. What are you watching for there as they look at this big bill and these kind of small bits that might be deal breakers?
Yes. So it's expected to be a different process in the Senate because the Democrats control it, like you said. So there's less danger of some of these quote unquote culture war amendments being included. However, Senator Joni Ernst from Iowa has introduced an amendment that, similar to the House provision, would force the Defense Department to roll back its abortion travel program. It's not clear yet whether Democratic leadership will bring this amendment up for a vote. Actually, Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer on the floor about an hour ago told members that he really wants the Senate NDA consideration to be as bipartisan as possible without amendments that could sort of sidetrack the chamber and lead into these partisan debates. But it's not clear yet what amendments will come up for consideration. We should know in the next couple of days.
Talking to Caroline Coudrier from CQ Roll Call about the big defense spending bill working its way through Congress. It passed the U.S. House narrowly with some of these controversial amendments we're talking about, and now heads to the Senate. You can join in with your thoughts, your reactions, your questions at 800-642-1234. 1234. Caroline, let's talk about the abortion-related part of this. Now, as I understand it, and please correct me if I'm wrong, since Roe v. Wade was overturned, the Defense Department is saying, okay, if you're a service member in a state where you can no longer access abortion services, you have to travel out of state to do that to a state that does, some of your travel expenses can be covered by the Defense Department. Is that, do I have that right? Is that what's at the heart of this right now?
Yes. So under the program, service members can have their travel expenses reimbursed, and they also get 3 weeks of leave in order to travel out of state if needed. As expected, Republicans have been opposed to this policy pretty much as soon as it began. It stems from Democratic concerns that service members who are living in states with strict abortion restrictions after the Supreme Court overturned Roe versus Wade might not be able to access abortion if they're stationed in one of those states. Senator Tommy Tuberville from Alabama has actually been blocking senior military nominations for almost 6 months over his opposition to this abortion policy. More than 270 nominations have not been considered, and all those roles are open because of that. So it's really become one of the, you know, most hot button fights in Congress this year in terms of to what extent the Defense Department should be facilitating reproductive health care for service members.
I wanted to ask you about that blockade in effect by Senator Tuberville. You've reported on that. The highest profile, the top job in the U.S. Marine Corps is among those with, I guess, an interim appointment now because of that blockade. Is there a thought that we might be nearing an end of that in some way?
It's really unclear how long it's going to keep going on. Senator Tuberville has said repeatedly that he either wants the DOD to rescind the abortion policy or he wants Congress to pass a law putting it into place. He argues that the policy does not line up with statute and its executive branch overreach. So it's possible that if the Senator Ernst abortion amendment that I talked about earlier does get adopted and the Defense Department is forced to roll back that abortion policy, that Senator Tuberville could lay off the holds. But until that happens, there's not really an off-ramp for it, and it's caused quite a good amount of angst among Senate Democrats and even some Senate Republicans who really want to see these positions go, you know, get filled. Because like you said, the Marine Corps has had a confirmed leader for, you know, decades and decades. This is the first time in over a century that role is open. And there are also several pretty important positions that are scheduled to come open in the next couple of months, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff being one, that if Senator Tuberville does not change his tactics, those could be open. And Democrats argue that that creates national security problems.
Caroline Coudrier is with us. She covers defense and national security for CQ Roll Call. We're talking about the national defense budget and what details were in the House bill passed last week. It goes to the Senate now. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have thoughts on the amount of money the United States puts into defense spending? What do you think of these amendments that look like they're going to be hangups at the very least on saying, hey, Department of Defense, you can't reimburse service members if they travel for abortion services? Diversity training, funding for Ukraine didn't end up in there, but do you have thoughts on that? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with Caroline Coudrier, Roll Call's defense and national security reporter, looking at the details of the U.S. House's nearly $900 billion military budget proposal. Some amendments in there that were controversial led it to it being a very partisan vote, likely to be stripped out by the U.S. Senate. And then what? You could join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 with your thoughts on some of these hot button issues related to abortion, diversity that ended up in this budget, funding for Ukraine that ended up not in that House plan, what you want to see happen next. Join in at 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Caroline, a big what's next question. Supposing the U.S. Senate takes this bill, passes it mostly as is, but leaves out some of the more controversial provisions we've been talking about. It goes back to the House, very narrow Republican majority. What would you be watching for in that scenario?
Yeah, so I think it'll really be a numbers game if we get to that point. You know, if McCarthy loses a couple of ultra-conservative Freedom Caucus members but still gets most Democrats on board with the bill, then they'll be totally fine. But a lot of the Democrats have pointed out that this abortion provision is a red line for them. They will not support the bill at all if it's included. So it'll really just be a balancing game of what McCarthy can get his caucus to support, and if he doesn't get the full membership of his caucus, how many Democrats he can bring over to sort of make those numbers up. I would predict that a lot of these more extreme provisions do get watered down, and that the conference committee version is more bipartisan, just because anything with too many conservative provisions just will not make it through the Democratic Senate and won't be signed by President Biden.
Now, there's been a recent custom anyway among House speakers, I think from either party, where they really don't want to pass a bill that they need help from the other party to pass. They really want their own party, their own majority to get them over the line. How much of a conflict do you think that could be for Speaker McCarthy if he doesn't get that majority just among Republicans and he needs Democrats?
I think that could definitely be an issue for him. Like you said, speakers really like to have the majorities of their caucuses voting for whatever they're trying to get through. If he does need Democrats to get it through, that definitely will be probably in the view of Freedom Caucus conservatives, an issue for his speakership overall. And you could see some sort of rebellion in that wing of the caucus, but it's too early to say how exactly that will go down.
I wanted to talk to you about the raw size of this, $900 billion. Sounds like a lot of money. Some in Congress, including Democrat Mark Pocan, a member from Wisconsin, criticized the size. He's looking for cuts in the spending, trying to get more. He's calling in a statement for more transparent government contracts, among other things, looking to cut waste in military spending. Was that even really part of the conversation in the House? Like, hey, maybe we should cut this back a little?
So actually, the size of the defense budget really wasn't a consideration this year. And the reason for that is because the overall top line for the Pentagon was already set in stone by the debt limit deal that President Biden and Republicans struck a couple of months ago. Under that deal, they agreed to spending caps for the next couple of years, and they had already decided that the defense budget can only be $886 billion. So there wasn't really room for much debate on that top line. But like you said, there are sort of wings of both the Democratic and Republican Party that are interested in cutting the Pentagon budget. Democrats like Mark Pocan, Ro Khanna was the only member of the House Armed Services Committee to vote against the bill in committee. He has philosophical issues with the size of the defense budget and typically votes against it. And then Republicans have spoken repeatedly about trying to trim quote-unquote woke programs at the Pentagon, some of the diversity programs that came up in the amendment consideration, and also climate change initiatives. So you sort of have parts of both parties that are interested in cutting, but because of the debt limit deal that was already struck, there just wasn't too much room for changing the top line. But something to keep an eye on later this year is that defense hawks from both parties could be interested in passing a supplemental funding package that would focus on Ukraine, potentially throw in some China deterrence initiatives. And that could spark another debate over whether the Pentagon should get even more money beyond what's in this bill.
I wanted to talk more about the Ukraine funding amendments that didn't make it into the final bill. There are some very vocal members of the Republican Party criticizing support for Ukraine, especially military and other financial support for Ukraine. How much traction did that get among the rank and file Republicans and Republican leadership, for that matter, in the House?
Yeah, so I mean, I think it got some support. Maybe about a third of the Republican caucus were supporting those amendments offered by Green, and Matt Gaetz is another big opponent of Ukraine aid. But for the most part, the majority of the Republican caucus is supportive of continuing to fund Ukraine, at least through the National Defense Authorization. I think if we do see a supplemental package later this year, Speaker McCarthy has said that he's not interested in that. And we could see some more divides start to appear among House Republicans and Senate Republicans, who are by and large very supportive of funding Ukraine. But for now, those arguments didn't pick up much traction. By and large, most members are supportive of Ukraine.
Talking to Caroline Coudrier from CQ Roll Call, looking at the National Defense Authorization Act, the thing that funds the U.S. military. Some controversial parts in a U.S. House bill passed with a Republican majority. Looking ahead, Caroline, what's the timeline now for this bill for being considered by the Senate and maybe being bounced back to the House?
Yeah, so the Senate is beginning consideration of its version, which is separate from the House version, this week. The first procedural vote is happening tonight. Senator Schumer has said that a package of 51 amendments is made in order, so they'll be going through all of those this week and next week, with potentially more to come. Then after the Senate goes through its version, the two chambers send representatives to meet in conference. That usually happens in the late fall. And then lawmakers will aim to get the whole bill passed by the end of the year. But this is Congress, so lots of times timelines are thrown off and different things create different issues, and it could get pushed back. But the military really argues that they want to get the NDA done on time. They want to get the defense appropriations bill, which actually provides the money itself. The NDA is just sort of authorizing that money. They really want that on time so they can continue their planning and carry out their programs as normal. So I think all the lawmakers would really like it to get done in the next couple of months, but who knows?
Now, sometimes we have these government funding bills and debt ceiling showdowns where, you know, parts of the government don't get funded if things don't get done by a deadline. Is that something that could happen here if they blow past the deadline by too far? Well, I don't know, what, military paychecks go unpaid? Is it that dire if this doesn't happen?
So because NDA is just the authorizing bill, if NDA gets delayed, it will cause some headaches for the military, but it won't cause any sort of shutdown. If they don't pass the defense appropriations bill, which actually sends the checks out, then that could cause the government shutdown. And given all the drama this year around the debt limit deal, and the fact that Republicans in the House Appropriations Committees want to spend even less than the amounts that that deal sort of laid out, there's definitely the potential for a government shutdown at some point. I think lawmakers would like to avoid it, but as we've seen in the past, that's not always enough.
Caroline, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
That was CQ Roll Call defense and national security reporter Caroline Coudrier. We've been talking about the National Defense Authorization Act that passed the U.S. House, now heads over to the Senate. Some sticking points likely to come out. We'll see where things go in the months to come. Now, around the country, 100,000 childcare workers have left that field since the start of the pandemic. That's contributed to a growing crisis for parents and daycare providers. But early childhood education programs at Wisconsin's technical colleges are thriving. Jenny Peek reports that that may be because state support for childcare is focusing on scholarships instead of boosting wages.
It's lunchtime at Red Caboose in Madison, and Morgan Cutler is helping 11-month-old Cassie with her meal. Like most days in the toddler room, more ends up on the floor and on Cutler than anywhere else. Cutler's worked at the Child Care Center since 2018, when she was working on a degree at Madison College.
I actually did my practicums here at Caboose when I was getting a tour done of the building. I was in the 3-year-old room. So a child came up and sat in my lap, and that solidified me, yeah, this is the right place for me.
But her family worries about her future in a job with staggeringly low pay. They've even pushed her to consider a more lucrative career.
I don't care if the pay is better. What I care about is, do I feel comfortable?
But low wages have pushed many childcare workers out, making it all the more surprising that the state's tech schools with early childhood education programs are stable, if not growing.
Last year, we saw a 10% increase in enrollment over the year before. Now, we're not to pre-pandemic levels yet, but that does tell me that we are going in the right direction.
That's Katie Pedersen. She's a director for the Wisconsin Technical College System. She says part of that success has to do with robust state funding for students who get degrees in early childhood education. More than 10,000 Wisconsin early childhood education students have gotten state scholarships since 1999. Jessica Chochi is a dean at Madison College. She calls the scholarship program a game changer.
I think our full-time equivalency has increased 40% this year because we've been able to award these scholarships to help students move through our program.
But a survey by the National Association for the Education of Young Children found 32% of the state's child care workers are considering leaving their jobs. They tie that to low wages and burnout. Nationally, federal data shows child care workers make an average of just $14 per hour.
That makes it really hard for people to want to get into the field. Regardless of your passions, you still have to eat.
That's Annie Tripp. They're finishing a degree in early childhood education at Madison College after 18 years in the field. They recently took an executive director job at a child care center, but that decision came after a months-long break from the work to consider other options.
When you put it all together with the emotional, the mental, the physical, I mean, the amount of physical labor that goes into this work, it's so severely undervalued by our society.
Federal pandemic relief boosted child care worker salaries and helped keep some centers afloat, but those funds are set to run out in early 2024. Democratic Governor Tony Evers proposed extending that support in the new state budget, but the Republican-controlled legislature removed it from the legislation. Madison College's Jessica Chochi says low wages are a hard truth in the industry.
Our students choose this because they care deeply about children. Our hope is that we help them find employment that meets their own financial needs and their own professional needs. But we are honest about the fact that the wages in childcare are incredibly challenging.
Back at Red Caboose, Morgan Cutler is helping the kids settle down for nap with some books.
Rambler, what do you see?
It's these little moments that help keep her in the career.
I love being at Red Caboose. I will never leave.
Right now, she says what childcare workers need most is help, or an extra set of arms.
Just so I can, you know, give this child a hug or separate these children when they're having a hard time. It's an amazing field. A lot of people don't appreciate it, but we need more people.
But without an increase in wages, it's hard to say when or if the industry will find more workers. Jenny Peek, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Coming up in just a few minutes here on Central Time, we're going to take a look at names and name changes, why people choose to change their names and how that's changed over history. I want to hear from you. You can email ideas@WPR.org. Did maybe when your family came over, immigrated to the United States a couple few generations ago, was there a big name change? What do you think about that? Do you wish you'd stuck with the original? Have you changed your name informally or legally at some point in your life? Love to hear about it. Email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Then you could join in that conversation coming up after the news. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent, get the latest on two labor strikes going on right now here in Wisconsin. One is at a brewery, the other at a dairy processing plant. Get both of those stories. That's coming up tomorrow morning at 7:30 on The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent here on the Ideas Network. A lot of people have a story about running into a celebrity in real life. My biggest, probably one time when I was a kid, I was in an elevator in Toronto with hockey legend Gordie Howe, which is a big deal because I was almost named after him. As part of my job, I get to interview famous people sometimes. I don't think that counts, though. But this last weekend, I did have a real-life celebrity encounter. I was on my way out of a grocery store near my house. As I was headed for the exit, who comes in? It's Larry Mueller from Wisconsin Public Radio. Now, of course, I was pretty starstruck, but I said hi, and he was just like a regular guy on his way in to buy something to grill later. Do you have a story like that about a brush with celebrity? Tell us about it. Email ideas@WPR.org. You know, I'm kind of kicking myself. I didn't think to ask for Larry's autograph. Maybe next time. Your home for celebrity gossip. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up today at 6 on 1A+, the hunt is on for a cure for autoimmune diseases. Together, they affect 1 in 5 Americans. They're much more common among women. Find out what we do know and what we don't know about autoimmune diseases today at 6 on 1A+. Now, your name could say a lot about you. It might carry your reputation, your identity as an individual. You might be named after someone and feel that deeper connection to them. Your last name might say something about your family, maybe where your ancestors came from. Or you might change your name legally or informally in daily use to better reflect who you see yourself as, the perception you want to give off. Historically, name changes were often a way to avoid discrimination, but over time, people's motivations for changing their names have also shifted. Our next guest has spent more than a decade researching name changes and ethnic identity to understand what our names say about us and why we might change them. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you changed your name for one reason or another, first and or last, legally or just, you know, what people call you in person? Why did you want to change it? And do you know the story of your family's last name? Was it changed maybe in the early days of immigration? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Kirsten Vermeiglich is a professor of history and Jewish studies at Michigan State University, where she researches the historical meanings and nature of ethnic identity. She's the author of several books. Her most recent is called A Rosenberg by Any Other Name, A History of Jewish Name Changing in America. Kirsten, welcome to Central Time.
Oh, thank you so much. I really appreciate your inviting me to be on this.
Now, you did some fascinating research for that book I mentioned. You look back now in New York, where so many immigrants started their experience in the United States, going back, looking over name-changing petitions in the U.S. for decades and decades. What inspired you to dig into those?
Oh, well, I usually say to people as a joke that when you have a name like Kirsten Vermeiglich, of course you're going to be interested in name changing.
The ferrets of the world, by the way, but I stuck with it.
Yeah, no, and we actually have family members who've changed their names even more, and there's a whole firm part of my family. But no, I didn't. I never changed my name. The name did used to be something long, slightly different, but it wasn't really. I mean, that played a role in it. I think I've always found names fascinating, but I'm also a scholar of American Jewish history and American history, and I have always been really interested in sort of the ways that people kind of use names to try to identify, particularly who's Jewish, you know, sort of ideas about sort of what a Jewish name is. And so I just thought it would be a really interesting place to go to kind of think about how people have defined their ethnic community and thought about who is and who's not in the community.
I have this notion in my head that there are so many people who came from Eastern Europe or Italy or you name it, and they hit Ellis Island, and that Ellis Island clerk simplified or Americanized their names. And according to your research, I guess not so much.
Yeah, I mean, you know, so my research, I usually sort of say that genealogists and anybody who's really looked at Ellis Island kind of knows that this isn't the case, that it certainly was not a wide scale phenomenon. There's no evidence of it. If you look sometimes, I mean, it's hard to do this on the radio. I sometimes will do this visually. If you look at manifests, which people listening to the show might have done genealogy, and they might have looked at the ship manifest where their ancestors came in. And if you look closely at those, you'll see little check marks. People at Ellis Island, the officials at Ellis Island actually didn't take record. They didn't actually write down anybody's name. They actually checked your name against your ship manifest. And there were actually rules at Ellis Island saying you could not change a name. And in fact, American law, all the states in the United States are actually very flexible in their naming, in the ability to change your name. So even if an Ellis Island official did change your name, you could just change it back really easily and quickly and unofficially. So usually, I and other scholars kind of want to emphasize that probably your name was not changed at Ellis Island, even though I know that's really disappointing and upsetting for people who've heard that story from families. And instead, what I found in my research is actually, if you look at name change petitions, so many people actually chose to change their names.
Let's talk about that. And in your research, you found that recent Jewish immigrants, or maybe even not so recent, changed their names, not just because they wanted to sound more American, but for very specific reasons. Discrimination. What did you find?
Yeah, I mean, I was really, when I went into my research, I really didn't know what to find. Really, nobody else has done this research before me. There's very little research into name changing. So I really didn't know what to expect. And I was really, really surprised to see, I mean, my first experience in walking into the archive the first day, I walked actually into the courthouse, and they just showed me into this little tiny room that just had wall-to-wall boxes of name change petitions and like huge huge numbers of them were all 1930s and 1940s, especially just boxes and boxes. So not during an era of major immigration. And instead, sort of the largest numbers came in the 1920s, 1930s, 1940s, 1950s, after immigration had actually slowed to a trickle. And so what was really interesting to see, so that was one thing that really surprised me. And the other thing that I hadn't really expected was how many Jewish surnames were being changed. Predominantly surnames, some first names too, but predominantly surnames. And it really matches up with the institution and sort of the spiraling of institutionalized anti-Semitism in the United States, which really rose in the 1920s, 1930s, and 1940s. And so I think it's really significant that all these Jews are changing their names at this time when they pay a penalty for having Jewish surnames or Jewish names at all. People sort of identify them and then won't give them jobs, won't let them into schools. And so I think that that was really significant that at that time, as people are experiencing this kind of discrimination, they're choosing to erase these names that kind of made them targets.
Talking to historian Kirsten Vermeiglisch from Michigan State University, looking at the history of name changes in the United States, why we change our names and how that changes over history. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a story maybe about the evolution of a name in your family, an official name change, or how the pronunciation maybe changed over the years? Have you changed your name for some reason? What led to that? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Kirsten, I imagine this must be an ambivalent moment for a lot of people historically. They would like to not be discriminated against. They'd like to get that job. So there's that incentive to change a name, but they might feel like, hey, what about this connection with, you know, my family and all of its history?
Yeah, no, it's very interesting. I mean, you know, what I wound up finding was a lot of both about sort of family history, but also about how people felt in the moment, their communities, right? So what I think a lot of people hadn't really looked at before, and what I think that I was able to find in my research was that certainly in the Jewish community, there was a lot of ambivalence and actually kind of anger and frustration with Jewish name changers, especially after World War II, you know, after the Holocaust, there was a great deal of kind of frustration and anger even directed at people who had changed their names. So people who changed their names reported being made fun of by members of their community. I found a petition of a man who had changed his name, and when he wanted to get married, the family he was marrying into made him change his name back. They refused to allow their daughter to get married to the changed name. So there were a lot of movies and books and other kinds of cultural artifacts that, you know, sort of made fun of name changers or kind of made them the villains in the stories. I think there was a lot of and a lot of kind of family disquiet. You know, I interviewed a few people who talked about sort of anger and frustration, or just unhappiness that they had this name that had been changed and they hadn't known about it, you know, family secrets and things like that. So yeah, I think that it led to, I think, some disruption and really sort of pointed to some fissures within the Jewish community as people had different responses to anti-Semitism. They had different responses to sort of how to deal with the discrimination they were facing.
In that time period, did you see other communities seeing similar waves of name changes? I think in pop culture of the Untouchables movie where a Giuseppe Petri becomes George Stone, was this happening with non-Jewish groups in New York?
Yeah, it's a really good question. And as I say, when I started doing the project, I actually thought I was going to see people of all groups changing their names. Maybe I didn't say that, but I should have. I didn't know what to expect. And I didn't necessarily think that it was going to be overwhelmingly Jews. And I most certainly did see Italians and Poles. I mean, it's New York, so it was inflected by the groups that are there. So a lot of Italians and Greeks, smaller numbers of people with Polish surnames. But I absolutely did see those. you know, one reason certainly there were many more Jews than there were those groups. And I think one reason for that is probably the kinds of jobs that Jews were looking for in comparison to other ethnic groups. Jews at that time, the 1920s and the 1930s, were predominantly looking for white or pink collar jobs. So clerks, women were looking for jobs as secretaries. And for a lot of other ethnic groups, Italians and Greeks, they might not have been looking for those kinds of jobs. Women would frequently stay outside of the paid workforce. Men were frequently looking for more working class jobs, maybe longshoremen jobs, union jobs. And those were jobs that at that time, you didn't need to fill out an application form. It's kind of weird to think about at this moment, but like the filling out of an application form and the way that your name might attract attention was really significant at this time in history. So Italians who might have changed their names, Poles who might have changed their names, they might not have felt that they needed to do so kind of legally and formally using these name change petitions. If they were working for working class jobs, they might have gone to like another union member, right? And been like, you know, can you find me a job at the factory? Or they might have found a job by standing on a street corner, right? And, you know, sort of getting a job. Domestic servants might have found a job that way. So Jews, both because they're experiencing more discrimination and also because they're looking for white collar work where they have to put their names down on a form in a way that other groups aren't. So I absolutely see, and this is not to say that I think other groups were absolutely changing their names, but maybe not in so many numbers because they're not facing the same kinds of, you know, this rise of anti-Semitism, but also because they're looking for different kinds of jobs. And so they show up in the economy in different ways, and their names aren't necessarily attracting the same kinds of negative attention that Jews are at that time.
Let's bring on a caller. Kristen is with us in Middleton. Kristen, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to tell us about?
I'm trying to mess with the phone here. I grew up outside of Detroit, and my father had always told me, oh, we go way back in the history of Detroit, back to the 1700s, but our name was not always Hall. It was some French name. And as I got into genealogy, I kept, it's my brick wall. I didn't know where to go with that. And with the help of some angels and some help, I finally found out what our French name was. And in Canada, the name was Michel Batry, but when they would cross the border, across the river into Detroit, because of the discrimination, they would use their stepfather's name. Back in 1803, the Batry wife married a man named Benjamin Hall. Uh-huh. So when they crossed to Detroit, they became Hall. They go back to the Windsor area, and they were Batry. So back and forth with baptismal papers over there was Batry. And
wow. But Kristen, thanks a lot for sharing that, and I'm glad you solved that mystery. Kirsten, I don't know if you have a lot of Quebecois people showing up to your records in New York, but that kind of back home, we were still old name. Over here, we are new name, I guess, probably didn't just happen in Detroit.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's a super fascinating story. Thank you so much for calling in. And it really does sort of show, I think, the significance of discrimination. I think so much of name changing, people sort of generally say, oh, people wanted to Americanize. But I think really thinking about the impact of discrimination on groups and the reasons, very practical reasons that people want to change names, I think that's a super important part of that story. And I think also another important part of that story is, yeah, wanting to keep connections to family. Right? People don't necessarily always want to just be remaking themselves and erasing their older family connections. They want to maintain those connections a lot of times. And so name changes is sometimes something that people see as very practical. And yeah, I mean, definitely there are super, definitely I found stories in New York of people who might have come and found, say, that their family members are using a different name, right? Their families have taken on a different name, and maybe they're living with that family, or their family has convinced them that this is, you know, a good name to take on in the United States, or they may themselves be experiencing discrimination, or they may feel that sort of to, you know, sort of present a level of kind of middle class respectability, right? If everybody in the family has that name, that it might be embarrassing for one last person not to have changed their name. So I think that there was some pressure there for people to take on the name that you know, other people had already taken on. So I think all of those kinds of factors play a role. I'm really so glad that you were able to find that too. I certainly talked to a lot of people who do genealogy and they can't figure out right. where it came from. Oh, that's wonderful that you were able to find that.
Thanks a lot for that call, Kristen. We're talking to Michigan State University History and Jewish Studies Professor Kirsten Vermeiglich about why we change our names, how our names shape our identities, historical trends in why and when people change their names. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Did your name change in your family's history, your last name? Have you changed your name? Join in at 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We continue our talk with Kirsten Vermeiglich. She researches ethnic identity as a professor of history at Michigan State University. She's with us today talking about the role our names play in our identities and why people change their names and why those reasons have changed over time. You could join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Kirsten, the reason people have changed their names has changed over time. You followed other ethnic groups at different points in history. What kind of things have stood out to you?
Well, so, you know, much of the work, I mean, certainly, and guided by what I saw in the archive, there was definitely this sort of phenomenon of Jews changing their names, say from like 1917 through the 1960s. And then Jews kind of fell out of the petitions, I think, as institutionalized anti-Semitism dropped out of the workforce. I think fewer people felt that they needed to change their names. But by the 21st century, the name changes remained pretty low, but then by 2001, in the years after 9/11, I saw a huge upsurge in name changing. The population of New York City changed. Far more people of color, people of Asian background, Latino, Black, Middle Eastern, North African peoples all moved into the city. And so by the years after 2001, by the 21st century, I really saw sort of an intense flourishing of name changing from all those different groups. Some of the ones that seemed sort of interesting to me were ones, I mean, there was no one group that kind of dominated, but there were a good number of Asian Americans changing their names in ways that were in some ways similar and some ways different from what happened earlier in the 20th century. And then also the case of Muslim Americans was also in some ways similar to what happened to Jews earlier, and then in some ways really, really different and really fascinating that sort of talks differently about what discrimination looks like today for different ethnic groups and people of color.
Did that post 9/11 wave continue for a long time, or was it a brief flare up of people with, I guess, Muslim sounding names changing their name just last for a couple years?
Yeah, no, it was really, I initially stopped my research I thought I would just stop with the 20th century. And then people said to me, you should really go look and see what happened after 9/11 to people with Muslim sounding and North African sounding names. And so I did, and I was really struck to see that in the years right after 9/11, that, you know, there was an upsurge in name changing among people who had names that sounded Muslim, people with names like Muhammad, people who had names like Osama, people with those kinds of names were changing their names in similar numbers, with a lot of the reasoning that sounded sometimes more explicit than what Jews had said earlier in the century. And sometimes that sounded exactly like what had happened earlier in the century. People worrying about not getting jobs, people worrying about not being able to get into school, people worried about sort of suspicion or anger or being embarrassed in front of, other people. I mean, really, sometimes really heartbreaking kinds of petitions. What I found striking was that the petitions did not stay as much of an upsurge. So by 2012, 11 years after 2001, I didn't see disproportionate numbers of people with Middle Eastern or North African names changing their names.
I want to bring on one more quick call before we run out of time. Sharon is with us in La Crosse. Sharon, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to bring up a couple points about first names being very feminine or very masculine, and that people that are transgender, changing their names, and sometimes that name change can be public. It can be a public notice, or you can have a judge that'll help you change it privately.
I gotcha, Sharon. We just have a few moments left, Kirsten, but that seems like it'd be an interesting field for future research, people who are changing gender identity and legally changing their names.
Yeah, actually, I'm just going to be publishing an article about that, actually. I think that's a fantastic point, and I'm so glad you brought it up. In addition to sort of seeing more Muslim names or more Asian American names, I actually found large numbers of people who are transgender changing their names. And New York City, actually, in terms of talking about doing it privately instead of publicly, New York City began to waive. You used to have to do it publicly, but New York City began waiving it because so many people who are transgender were afraid for their safety. And so now you can do that more privately. So that is a really important contemporary trend in name changing. I'm so glad you brought that up.
Thanks for that call, Sharon. And Kirsten, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me. I really enjoyed this. Have a wonderful day.
You too. That's Kirsten Vermeiglich, professor of history and Jewish studies at Michigan State University, author of the book A Rosenberg by Any Other Name, A History of Jewish Name Changing in America. She's with us today to talk about name changing, how trends in why people change their names have changed over time. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, Wisconsin businesses are less worried about a recession, but many owners say they're holding off on hiring. We'll get the details from a new survey of businesses in the state, find out what it all means for maybe your job. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Coming up after the news, the Women's World Cup is kicking off later this week, and the U.S. team is favored, at least for now, to take home their third trophy in a row. Two sports anchors from Telemundo, Wisconsin, tell us what to watch for during the tournament. I'm Rob Barrett. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.